last speaker is Alice Fulmer and colleagues. Alice received her graduate degree from UNC Chapel Hill in Environmental Science and Engineering, and she's now at the Water Research Foundation with offices in Denver, Colorado, and Raleigh, and she will introduce that foundation herself. So.
Great. Well, thank you. I'm so pleased to be here. So I'm kind of coming to you guys from a bit of a different angle. This is one of the less technical talks that I do. I'm going to be talking about contaminants of emerging concern and public health, but more from a standpoint of communication and collaboration. And I do represent the water industry, water community, the drinking water community. And so it's my first time at the American Public Health Association conference. I don't know if you guys are aware, we actually have a water quality and treatment conference going on in New Orleans at the same time. So this represented a really great opportunity, and I'll be giving a slightly varied version of this there this afternoon. First, just to say I don't have any relationships to disclose other than the organization I'll tell you about in a minute. But just to sort of introduce the topic, I'm guessing that these sorts of headlines may look familiar to you. These are a lot of the headlines that you'll see in the media about some of the contaminants of emerging concern in water, mainly pharmaceuticals. And, you know, they are not necessarily factual, so I love this facts over fear ribbon here, and you can see one of the comics that gets tossed around a lot at our water conferences about, you know, is it a boy or a girl? Actually, who knows, thanks to all of these chemicals in the water, it's both. So we'll talk about that more this afternoon, but who is the Water Research Foundation? We used to be associated with the American Water Works Association, which is also a member-supported, more trade group, but we really focus exclusively on research. We have mostly drinking water utilities that voluntarily subscribe to us so that they can support research on the area. So our mission is to advance the science of water. So we hope to protect public health as that end goal. We funded about 1,000 research projects since we were started in 1966 at a value of over $500 million. So we're really an example of the drinking water utilities being proactive to fund research that goes beyond what they currently have to meet by typical water standards. So what do we mean when we're talking about contaminants of emerging concern? Here's the EPA definition. It's chemicals that are not currently regulated, but they are either newly found in water, or they're found in water at levels that are different than they were previously. A lot of them have unknown health effects. This is why they're not regulated. So some examples of these are endocrine disrupting compounds, hexavalent chromium, nitrosamines, which are a disinfection byproduct, some of the perfluorinated chemicals, cyanotoxins that you're hearing a lot about, and a really good example would be the MCHM chemical from the West Virginia spill that I'm sure no one's heard about this year. So how are these, again, this is just one example, this is a pharmaceutical, but how are a lot of these contaminants getting into our water? In the case of pharmaceuticals, you've got where you may have industrial discharges from their production, and after they're distributed, some of them are not completely metabolized in your body, so they can be excreted. They can also enter the water system through improper disposal. Once they are in the water system, they're not completely treated through our wastewater treatment plants, or they may actually be given to livestock, and so they can enter through runoff that way. And then, of course, for some of the other contaminants, there's other avenues as well. But, you know, given the cyclical nature of wastewater and drinking water, we are ending up with these in our water supply and in our drinking water. And we're hearing about them a lot more lately because we can see them where we couldn't see them before. So, you know, the analytical capabilities have just grown astronomically in the last couple of decades. So we probably have had these in the water for a long time. We just couldn't see them. Now we can see down to these parts per trillion levels. And that is part of the challenge as drinking water utilities see it. Also, the evolving state of the science. How do we talk to our consumers about the risk of something when the state of the science is evolving so quickly? And it's very hard to keep up, and it may be written in language that we're not accustomed to. There's regulatory challenges. The Toxic Substances Control Act does not require pre-market testing of a lot of the chemicals, so we don't have a lot of the data that we need. From the drinking water side of things, we heard a little bit about the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, the last amendments were in 1996, and since then EPA has put out some new regulations, but not of a new contaminant, and this is partly due to this individual contaminant approach and the need to demonstrate, you know, that you're going to get sufficient health benefit, and there's just this huge soup of chemicals. So it's really challenging for the EPA. Also, as you have more of our drinking water sources being impacted by wastewater, this connection between the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act becomes ever more important. And unfortunately, there really is a disconnect between what folks can discharge and what is acceptable on the drinking water side of things. And then you've just got constrained resources. As we all know, the EPA is constrained. They're not having a lot of money. Water systems don't have a lot of money. Many of them are municipals that are challenged. And then you've got the really small guys, somewhere between the wells that we were hearing about earlier, and then the large municipalities where you've got these small systems that unfortunately aren't even able to comply with some of the existing regulations, especially arsenic, for example. And so while you've got that, how do you focus on these other contaminants that are in the media a lot, but we don't really know if we need to be worried about them or not? To compound that further, we've got treatment challenges. So we'd love to employ this precautionary principle where we just, if they're in the water, we don't need to know if they're at what levels to be concerned yet. Let's just get them out. But the a lot of these require advanced treatment techniques that are very expensive to remove them. And they can increase greenhouse gas emissions, especially if you're talking about some of the membrane technologies, et cetera. And any of those costs would have to be passed on to their consumers. So how do you justify, when you have all of these other really important public health needs, making these treatment plant upgrades if, in fact, you don't have the public health data yet to support them? And then you may result in an affordability issue where you've got people of low incomes who are barely able to pay their water bills now and would much rather them have access to clean water than not being able to afford it. And of course, I don't know how much it gets into your world, but you know, infrastructure needs in the drinking water industry are just astronomical. We keep hearing higher and higher estimates in terms of what we really need to invest in our pipes to keep them running without further main breaks. We obviously have aging distribution systems to be concerned about. And then even if we are treating these contaminants, we sometimes have to worry about transformation of these contaminants from disinfection. So even though disinfection is, as Liam was talking about, this amazing achievement of the last 100 years, and in fact one of my colleagues, Michael McGuire, is talking this afternoon about a book he wrote, The Chlorine Revolution. I think it's at 4:30. I would encourage you to go. But that same oxidation can transform some of these compounds into other contaminants with similar effects. So there's really just still a lot of challenges in this area, not to mention the media challenge where you've got covers like this one that are calling this issue to attention. So the utilities are perceived as sort of that last line of defense. So even though a lot of folks were getting this exposure from using these personal care products or these pharmaceuticals, we're drinking water, and we don't really have the choice about that matter unless you can afford bottled water. So they're sort of that stopgap, and they're perceived as being responsible for the presence of these contaminants. And, you know, in many ways, they are the ones who resources weren't an issue, could get them out. But, you know, it is us as a society that's helping these contaminants get into the water and our choices. And then in terms of addressing the issue, they're really trying to be as proactive as possible to talk with their consumers about the issue of contaminants of emerging concern in water. But, you know, they may not be the ones that consumers are most wanting to hear from or most trusting. They may feel that they have a conflict of interest in this matter because they want them to continue drinking their water. And so let's why I'm here with you all. The medical and the public health agencies are much more trusted on this matter. But then on the flip side, they may not understand some of the drinking water issues because you all are trained in so many other important areas. So one of the things that my agency talked about is, that we funded is this workshop, Broadening the National Dialogue on CECs and Public Health. The objective here was to bring these two groups together. We had medical practitioners, we had public health organizations, we had drinking water utility representatives, we had drinking water researchers, all come together and sort of exchange information about the state of the science and their current understandings and how we can work together on this issue moving forward. So here's just a picture of some of the folks from the workshop, and what did we learn? We really learned about one another's perspectives and where everyone's coming from. We learned some of the latest research, and we were able to identify some wonderful opportunities for collaboration, which is the end goal of what I wanted to talk to you all about today. But maybe I've covered this sufficiently already. Again, the water utility perspective is that we want to get ahead of these issues. We know there's not regulations on them right now, but we want to protect public health. We want to be prepared for if there are regulations, but we just don't have that definitive human health information to talk confidently with our consumers. For the most part, we do know how to remove them, but we lack the resources to do so. And they have the same questions that a lot of the public health folks did. You know, what are the impacts of long-term exposure? How much of this exposure comes from drinking water versus food versus air versus our use of these or products containing these compounds? Really want some direction from regulators. So I think there was a we talked to some of the, we also had NGOs at this workshop, and they felt that utilities didn't want to be regulated, and yet they're actually saying, no, that might help us here, you know, be able to justify these costs or at least know whether we need to be worried here. And they really want to form collaborations and want help from the public health organizations and practitioners on this issue. The practitioners that attended the workshop felt there were some good opportunities. We had one gentleman who represented the pediatric environmental health specialty units. These are a resource for doctors to help answer some questions that they might be getting from their patients about environmental issues, and they thought there was a great opportunity for them to work with regional water groups and other groups to develop some of the information to help answer those questions. They were also telling us that, you know, the utilities, we have our own conferences, we have our own information, but if we want to engage the practitioners, we need to have information very much readily available for them. Obviously, you guys have other priorities, competing priorities to deal with. And they also noticed that we were talking about a terminology, you know, two completely different languages, even though we have the same goals and maybe the same background in education. So they were talking about the need to sort of come up with some common terminology or at least get a better understanding of one another's terminology. Wonderfully, the EPA and PESU regions are the same, so we thought this has some good potential for collaboration here. We had water researchers there, and they were talking about their concerns. And, you know, as we are forced to use more compromised water sources due to drought and other water availability issues, this issue is only going to increase. Basically, we have a lot of de facto reuse or unplanned potable reuse, where you see in the picture here, you've got a wastewater treatment plant upstream that's discharging, you've got a drinking water treatment plant downstream that's got their intake. They may not be practicing direct potable reuse, but they're practicing indirect potable reuse, and this is increasing. Also, they were talking about the need to consider those byproducts that I mentioned earlier, and how, you know, they want stronger messages, but we need more science. Of course, they were talking about we need more funding for research. And then we had a public health researcher that was very informative. We had a few, actually, I should say, one of them representing this TOX21 program, where they're really trying to quickly prioritize these 80,000 chemicals that are on EPA's list and on the NIEHS research docket to hopefully give us some direction about what we need to focus regulatory attention on. They feel there is a lot of evidence that, you know, previously we're saying, don't know, is there evidence that we need to be concerned about these chemicals? And even though we don't yet know exactly which chemicals and at what levels to be concerned about, they were talking about there are definite increases in chronic disease that are thought to be associated with the widespread increase in use of chemicals. And there is a World Health Organization report talking about pharmaceuticals in water that came out last year, another one specifically on endocrine disrupting compounds in water that is citing more and more studies showing the correlation and the fact that we do really need to be concerned here. So there's a lot of research ongoing in that area. Obviously, children are uniquely vulnerable to these compounds, and they felt strongly that we need to modernize the Toxic Substances Control Act to account for that vulnerability in children. One of the issues that we all recognized was that in our current regulatory framework, you do all of this research and you finally identify an issue with one particular compound. Here you've got bisphenol A or BPA. Well, the way our world works is, okay, great, we'll come up with a replacement for BPA, only in this case, not only is it similar, but it may actually be worse in terms of endocrine disruption. So by taking this contaminant-by-contaminant approach, we're not necessarily solving the big-picture problem. Here you had an example where it actually doesn't even degrade as easily as BPA. So after we had all of these presentations, we identified some common understandings, and I think I may be running a little later on time than I wanted to, but okay, great. So we thought it was important to identify what we all felt we knew confidently, where we still had some uncertainties, and how we might, in light of those, improve our communication strategies. So we recognized we all had the same goal in mind. We all want to ensure healthy and safe water. We did all recognize that we thought there was a disconnect between not those in the room, not the priorities of those in the room, but the concerns of the public at large versus the public health professionals in the room. They didn't necessarily line up. We also recognize that we really need to work hard to improve our communication, and some of this is what I mentioned earlier. As far as technical uncertainties go, there's so much research needs in here. In this area, I don't have time to go into them all, but we need a better understanding of the sources, the transformations, the exposure pathways, the relative source contributions, on and on and on. We need comprehensive studies of human health effects, so whatever does emerge at the top of from that TOX 21 program, we need funding to research it. We need to look at mixtures, because we're all not exposed, obviously, to one chemical at a time. We're exposed to these soups, if you will, and then we still felt the risk communication is an uncertainty, not necessarily technical uncertainty, but how do you talk about something for which you don't necessarily know all the facts without provoking undue alarm? And then we talked about how can we better come up with or better develop communication pieces. We need to partner with other organizations. We need some best practices documented, and we need to really get a better feel for our audience and try to tailor the messages accordingly. So a lot of, we did end up with a workshop summary report and several position papers that are all available on the Water Research Foundation website, so I would encourage you to go there if you're interested. Also, in general, any Water Research Foundation projects are all on that website and can be accessed there. Example of a position paper. So what are some of the recommendations? So after we identified those commonalities and uncertainties, we came up with some ideas for how we could continue to communicate and how we could collaborate. How can we put into practice some of what we just talked about? One of the examples was cross-discipline outreach. Why don't someone from the water industry come to the APHA meeting and vice versa? So I'm living proof of the first recommendation here. Everyone really came away from the meeting feeling that this was so valuable. I want to continue it, but somebody's got to fund it to pay for everyone to come. So we're looking for other ways to keep funding these kinds of workshops, hopefully every couple of years, or just start attending one another's conferences. Just expert participation and individuals working together through fellowship programs would be a great way to work together more. And then just enhancing the dialogue even within our own organizations. So how can we collaborate better? Well, for us, we're trying to identify for specific utilities and regions what public health groups are the best to work with. And then how can we strengthen those connections with them? And again, there's more details in the report here. But we wanted to start some interdisciplinary work groups that could be ongoing to talk about these opportunities. And we thought it was a great idea to go ahead and start working with these PACEWs that I mentioned before. Again, talking about some public outreach, we really should try to agree on some key messages and templates that can be used to share with the public. I think I alluded to the West Virginia spill at the start of the talk. Here was an example where you had groups that were all saying different things, and it really undermined the communication efforts of all of them. You had CDC saying one thing, you had the West Virginia public health groups or Department of Health saying another, and even still the American Water West Virginia saying something else. And it's so challenging. So we need to try and agree on key messages and then go out there and deliver them consistently so that we can build that trust. I want to try and find some national champions that can help with that. And then we identified a few research needs that could help build that collaboration and test those collaborations. So a lot of you are probably aware of sort of emergency preparedness and response training. I know I did some of this way many years ago where you get out there, you have these tabletop exercises. Well, in this case, it's not so much an emergency, but let's do some role-playing when we have an identification of a unregulated contaminant that is causing alarm and seeing how we might work together to communicate with the public. And then another recommendation is to host a pilot test project where we're working with those PACEWs that I mentioned, for example, and we could look at some case studies, what has worked in areas where they're working together well and what hasn't. Let's have some pilot tests and identify some data gaps and work out a better format. So we personally as an organization are working to fund some of these, but we're still trying to work with other organizations as well to try and get some joint funding for this. If I have a closing, it's just to encourage you all to, reach out to your water utilities if you have some questions or if you're ever getting asked, and we'll be doing the same. So lots of acknowledgments for my co-authors and then other key participants at the workshop that helped provide some slides. And then lastly, I'll just thank you all for listening. That's my little guy. So I have a personal interest in contaminants and water. And there's my email address if any of you want to contact me further. So.
We do have a few minutes for any questions for the last speaker and then for anyone overall on the panel.
That is the one, and again, we defined contaminants of emerging concern very broadly. The endocrine disrupting compounds is definitely the group where we feel there is some evidence there. The issue then becomes in terms of drinking water versus wastewater, where can you remove these, and do you actually remove enough to sort of matter from a relative source contribution standpoint? And certainly we would love to see more work from EPA, even though they do have an endocrine disrupting screening program, et cetera, to try and develop that where drinking water utility could justify some of the treatment plant upgrades. But at this point, the thought was maybe we need to focus on wastewater treatment, for example, or some revisions to some of the manufacturing guidelines like TSCA, et cetera, to try and prevent them in the first place. So I agree with you. I think that's the one chemical compound group where there is increasing evidence, and it's just a matter of sort of how do we best address it. So the Water Research Foundation actually has some other research ongoing that's looking at holistic management strategies for those specifically, and how can we work with the wastewater utilities, with the regulatory officials to come up with a better strategy for that. But yeah, you're right. But in terms of communications, it's still a very large challenge.
Any other questions?
Sure.
You mentioned bottled water as an alternative. I think that was kind of like an aside earlier in your talk.
Oh, I mentioned it in terms of the affordability issue of water.
Right. Are you aware of whether or not they're actually testing for any of the stuff in bottled water?
They are not. They're not required to anyway. So drinking water, bottled water is covered under FDA as opposed to Safe Drinking Water Act. So they are not required to. Now, most of them are employing treatment technologies like reverse osmosis or others that are probably removing a good portion of them. You do still have to worry about phthalates and other things leaching from the bottles themselves. So and we have seen BPA and other compounds in bottled water. So it's not that is a... I did not mean to imply at all that that is a solution, because I'm not an advocate of bottled water. But they're not required to. They may be doing.